Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome to The Whole Shebang. I'm speaking to you, broadcasting to you from Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today's program is the first of a series of shows I'm going to do, and this is around historic breeds of livestock. Fad, finished, or fighting back. I aim to go deeper and to get some different answers and to get behind the story. And hopefully I'll illuminate, pontificate, and to some cases titillate around a different range of subjects. So this week it's historic breeds. We aim for good guests, and in that sense we've got some great people coming on the show today. But first a little bit about why I'm interested in these historic breeds. I farmed in the UK for many years, and we kept these breeds as a matter of course. They weren't traditional, they weren't historic, they weren't heritage, it's what we farmed. And now they seem to be on a list of endangered, very often endangered, and animals in need of preservation. So here's the thing. I'm looking to bring in today lots of interesting guests for you. From the Livestock Conservancy here in the United States, we have Eric Hullman. He is the executive director, and he is going to be joined by Tom Beeston, who is the chief executive of the Rare Breed Survival Trust. Now, Eric has been with the Livestock Conservancy since 2012. He's from a biotech and entrepreneurial background. Tom, too, has been fairly new on the scene and only came into the Rare Breed Survival Trust in 2014. Both these guys came to these organizations that were in a certain amount of flux at the time, in need of direction, and both of them are doing a sterling job. They're bringing skills, lots of good skills, to the whole situation. The Rare Breed Survival Trust was set up in 1973, and since that time has not lost any breeds at all. In between 1900 and 1976, 26 breeds in the UK were lost. The Livestock Conservancy was set up in 77, again, to preserve and look after these wonderful breeds of livestock. So, as I say, we'll be bringing them on very shortly. My story is that I farm these breeds, and I care, and I want to bring that story to you. So joining us from North Carolina is Eric Hullman. Eric, hi.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on. I'm real excited about the show, and I'm excited that you've made the international flavor I think will be a great thing.
Thank you. And joining us from the UK, Tom Beeston. Tom, hi.
Hello, John. Thank you again for inviting us. It's nice to be talking to people on the other side of the pond.
It's great having you on, and for me, it's a great excitement having the two of you together for the first time together, coming on and sharing ideas. And really stripping back to basics as to what these animals are. What constitutes a rare breed, a heritage breed? Tom, could you kick off and could you give us an idea for the listeners? What exactly are these breeds? What's rare? What's traditional? What's heirloom? Why do we even bother?
Why do we bother? What are they? Right, we probably have slightly different measures, but probably not that million miles away from what Eric would do with you over there. We sort of look about it being a traditional breed or a native breed, we'd say, and then we look to see if it's rare. So we're looking for breeds that have been in the UK for at least 40 years, and then in addition to that, six generations. So for different species, that'll be longer. So it could be anything up to 100 years ago. Or anything as little as 50 years ago, we just bring in land-raised pigs, British land-raised pigs, onto our lists. But then if we talk about it being rare, it's sort of like with something like cattle, it's something with less than 1,500 breeding females left in the country.
Oh, that's getting quite serious on that score. Eric, if I could chuck the ball to you on that one, are you operating in the same parameters with the Livestock Conservancy? Are those the rules you follow in relating to how you classify and how you determine if a breed is rare or endangered?
Certainly. Yeah, and Tom, it's just a great pleasure to meet you, and I've been looking forward to this, and I look forward to, in the future, working more closely together, and it's a worldwide issue, so I'm glad.
It is worldwide, yeah. Right.
Brought us together. Likewise.
Hands across the Atlantic's a wonderful thing.
So, yes, just like Tom's organization, we're a science-based organization, so every year we do a census, and we look at the different breeds that are endangered, and we have different categories. Critical is the one where we're most concerned with, and that's where we have fewer than 200 annual registrations and a population of less than 2,000, and then we go from there to threatened, to watched, to recovery, and then we have a category of study, which is our breeds that we aren't quite sure about the numbers yet, and we're still trying to figure those out. But like Tom, we look at historic breeds, so they have to have been around for a while. We also look at the international numbers, so even though they may be rare in this country, if they're doing great in another country, then there's not... We don't need to spend our efforts on that.
Oh, that's admirable. That's good. I gather, interestingly, there are breeds which you both share, breeds that are on the lists in the UK and in the US. There's some notable examples of the Milking Shorthorn. There's goats, there's horses, there's the Lincoln, the Dorset Horn. And I'm reading a list here, Clun Forest, Jacobs, a whole range of animals which you two guys sort of share and have in common. Is that something where you feel you can get together on in the future?
If we look at the domesticated breeds in North America, most of those came from Europe, and we have a few that didn't come, but most of them came from Europe, so we're very conscious of the genetics that we have, and with the need to refresh some of those genetics by reaching across to where these breeds came from to make sure that we are good stewards of those breeds. So yes, that it's really critical. And I know, John, and you and I have talked about some of the barriers between getting genetics back and forth between here and say the UK on things. Like some of the breeds that we've been working with, particularly in the sheep breed. So
yeah, and I believe it. I think it's fair to say that the rules have changed as we speak in relation to the importation of goat and sheep semen from the UK to the US. There are moves afoot to free that up. So that will be, I suspect, a lifeline for quite a few breeds over here, and something which I suspect perhaps you guys will be working together closely on. I think, Tom, I think it's right in saying that during the war, when we looked as if we may be invaded, that some breeds were actually evacuated to the US for safekeeping. I think it was the White Park cattle.
Yeah, I think there was some White Park cattle, and I think there was also some of the Dutch cattle were brought back over there as well. And that's the sort of stuff we still do, you know, on a smaller scale over here. We send stuff to different islands so that, you know, it's not just about being genetically small as a population. We've got breeds that are genetically limited by geography. So if we take our Exmoor ponies, they're all really from one genetic pool,
right,
or living in one very small area. I think some of the things that you, as well, John, that you say about the populations, you know, some of the populations you've got in the state states are probably purer than ours. I think if we talked about Jacobs, our Jacobs are probably not as historic as your Jacobs.
That's correct. And I think the Milking Shorthorn over here, too, is probably pure. In fact, I think it's thought that perhaps from the UK there is less credence given to the purity of some of the breeds here. But that's a story for another day.
Yeah.
So it's all about the breeds. You both are looking towards tying up with the slow food movement and the slow meat movement particularly. And I know that both organizations are very excited about the possible chance to work with Slow Food USA and Slow Food UK. Eric, you're looking to forge closer links. And in fact, we've got Megan Lama coming on shortly, who is from Slow Food USA, to talk about some of the issues. But perhaps, Eric, you could explain the thinking in relation to slow meat and why you feel that's important for the Livestock Conservancy.
Yeah, certainly. Thanks, John. Yeah, our relationship with Slow Foods goes back quite a while, quite a long time ago. We started working with them on the Arc of Taste and getting different some of our breeds on the Arc of Taste, and probably one of the most successful programs we had with Slow Foods USA was the reintroduction of the heritage turkey to the table. So that's an exciting that was a successful collaboration, and we're looking to do more with them now. We just working with, I don't know if it was with Megan or who it was at Slow Foods, is working with Jeanette Berenger to, has recruited 7 chefs in the Northeast to get the Old English game birds back on the table. So we're starting to work with those chefs, and the chefs are trying to figure out how to best work with those birds. But our interest in slow meat, to answer your question, is If I could summarize, and I hope Richard McCarthy, the executive director, have a different vision than he does, is that the slow meat is exciting for us because it will hopefully do for local access to local meats what farmers markets and CSAs have done for access to local vegetables.
Right.
That it'll help us use the grassroots power of Slow Foods USA to maybe break down some of those barriers to access to your local meat supplier.
I see, and I know Tom, you're very, very excited about your collaboration that's going to be launched at the Three Counties Show in the UK in June, I think, where you with the slow meat UK folk. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I had the good fortune to meet Richard and his team in Terra Madre in Italy a few weeks ago with the UK guys over here, a guy called Colin Baum. So the sort of model I'd just mirror what Eric just said, really, in a way. We've got probably 4,500 small producers, some of which are probably commercially viable, but links to the marketplace and creating some new supply chains would be really fantastic. And in the UK, particularly Slow Food works very close with a lot of the top-end chefs. And like Eric, we've worked with Slow Food for a long time. And personally, I've been involved with it a long time over here. So it's sort of a marriage made in heaven, really, I think.
if there is such a thing, you know. Yeah. Because is it the case with some of these breeds, because they've been off the radar for so long, that chefs actually having to learn how to handle them, how to use them? I think, Eric, particularly, I was talking to Jeanette in relation to the Old English game, and there's several chefs in New York here that are looking to use them, and they're having to scratch their heads and think of it, because this is a different beast to the animal that you'll be buying sort of on a piece of styrofoam covered in Perspex or plastic, whatever it is, from your local store. These animals are a different taste, and will their work be done researching how to cook this stuff?
Certainly, we recently finished up a study on heritage swine and worked with a number of chefs around the country on those. And you know, these are not your traditional pink pigs, and they're either lard pigs or other small pigs. And so there is a different approach. And the chefs we've talked with, the ones that get it, that understand it, and there are more and more of them, embrace this challenge, that this is something that it really excites them to take something and try to figure out how best to use that, how best to present that.
How to take it all on. I don't know how it works in the UK, but the slow meat mantra is basically that you eat less meat, but you eat better quality and probably a traditional, more traditional breed. But really, to my way of thinking, you need to eat more, not less. And so I can see where they're coming from in that you make it a special occasion and they have their meatless Mondays and things like that. But I certainly think that it's going to be very exciting. And do you see that as a way that both your organizations, Tom, that you will form alliances with other organizations, sort of unity through strength?
Oh, without any question about that, it's not just in the meat area. You know, we do it in different organizations. On sort of conservation grazing over here, which is probably slightly different than the States, but our heritage breeds are used to graze nature reserves, so we have close links. Our patron has got us working on a project on Coronation Meadows, where we're grazing meadows to increase biodiversity, and then on this with the chefs, without any question about. But going back to what you said about educating chefs, I've been working with one chef that... I think I sent you an article on earlier, a guy called Cyrus Toddywalla in London.
That's right,
he's got three great restaurants over there. And, you know, it's not just learning about how to cook it, it's learning how to buy it so that the farmers can actually supply it because of the difference in the supply chains, you know, and creating those supply chains as well. And I'm getting a few ambassadors around that can do that. Cyrus has been fantastic, and I've worked with him probably for about, on this type of thing, but from different angles, for about 10 years. But we need ambassadors like him that can actually go and explain to chefs that if they want to have these products, which are far higher quality, mm-hmm. far more taste, cook better. He's an Indian, originally a Farsi. So, like, some of his dishes he's cooking for a long time. So mutton's fantastic for him. And some of the pork he's using, you know, if you use modern pork, he can't actually cook it to do what he wants it to do. So he's going back to native breeds because it cooks so much better for him.
Yeah. No, that's the way you handle this stuff is so vitally important to present it. And I think one of the issues that is the continuity of supply. You know, it's all very well to trumpet that you've got this stuff, but you've got to be able to supply it to the customer, be it a chef and therefore the people the chefs are feeding on a regular basis. Otherwise, people forget about it and it kind of goes off the radar. I just like to your patron. When you say you talk of your patron, who, as perhaps our listeners don't know, is HRH Prince Charles. And how big for you is it having somebody so notable taking such a close interest in your work?
Oh, it's actually for us. It's really good news. You know, we had a conference with some of our conservation grazing guys in the summer, and by him speaking there, and because he's so passionate about these things. So, you know, it's not just because he's actually, you know, the high and mighty and very well recognized. This guy loves food, farming and wildlife and heritage and sustainability. So you're actually listening to somebody and working with somebody who's actually got a lot to add to it. He's probably one of the most qualified people internationally to talk on these things. So it's a double whammy. You know, people want to talk to him because he talks and lives the right thing. And he's extremely supportive in so many ways.
It's great. I know Prince William and Kate were in New York recently, and I was going to try and get them to come along, but you know they were tied up. So you know, I think they were having too big a time with LeBron James, actually. So that was so that was a non-starter. Membership. Both organisations have members, obviously, because it's the members that very often keep the livestock. How do you see? Perhaps I could go to Eric first. How do you see the Livestock Conservancy's sort of bigger picture in relation to its membership and obviously fundraising in the near future?
That is the $64,000 question, and Tom, I'd be interested in your take on this. What we're seeing is tremendous growth in interest, but not a corresponding growth in membership. And I think for membership organizations, regardless of what you are, it's difficult now. People don't necessarily become members of things they support. They will be happy to donate $5 or $10 a month from their credit card, but they're unlikely to sign up as members. And what we don't want to do is have the people that are actually doing the work, that are actually on the ground getting their hands dirty, be the ones that are supporting this effort. We want to get the word out far and wide so that everyone understands how important this mission is and that our support comes from a much broader base. And we're questioning whether that is through membership or just through getting the word out through our podcast, through our new book, through our website. So I'm curious how Tom's organization is faring with the same issue.
Tom, perhaps you could shed some light.
Well, I think we're probably in a slightly different situation because just of the physical size and intensity of the population over here. Geographically, area-wise, Eric's got a large area to cover. So we've got 25 groups that cover nearly all the major agricultural and the small agricultural shows in the UK. So I see we've got over a long period, a great opportunity to actually go out and focus on recruiting members. So we're quite lucky from that point of view. And over here, with government funding going, which we've never had very much of, but the increased competition for the charity pound, we do see on a 10-year plan that we've got to grow our membership, but see a great potential to do that because we've never actually tried to beforehand. And the Brits are very philanthropic on the membership sort of giving type thing to support charities. So, it's probably if we do it right, we've got quite a positive outlook on it. And within 10 years, we expect nearly all our core funding to come from that type of fundraising. But I do talk 10 years, not 10 weeks.
So you're in for the long haul?
Yeah.
You've been at the Rare Breed Survival Trust a relatively short space of time, and you came in to take on what I think was probably an interesting situation, inverted commas, in relation to the rare breeds. And I have to say, you're doing sterling stuff, and how you've kind of getting the organization turned around and going the right direction is very laudable and good on you. I'd like to come on to now is talking about the need to keep these breeds pure. And that I think, Tom, you're going to launch a scheme whereby you will give some kind of certification to a butcher or a restaurant that uses animals that are actually where both of the parents, that's the mum and the dad, are both registered, shall we say, rare breed.
Oh, registered native breed, we'd probably say, actually, because even some of the ones that are more common, we want to keep going. But that might even mean they're crossed, John.
Right.
Because, as you probably know, having sort of done sheep over here and pigs over here, that makes them sometimes an improved thing. But we need to get those genetics going. We don't know what we'll need those genetics for going forward in the future.
Right.
We have climate change, and we can see it over here. The weather is changing. The temperature is increasing. Whether that sort of continues out by vein. We've got massive disease problems, which I'm sure is linked to that over here now. We've got avian flu coming over here. We've got tuberculosis in animals. We had mad cow disease a while back. And land prices over here are £10,000 or $15,000 an acre. We've got to find different ways of producing these products. And these breeds do things differently. Yeah. And, yeah.
So... if I could just bring in Eric on that one. I think the view of the Livestock Conservancy that the parents can be two different breeds as long as they're heritage breeds and it can still be called heritage. Is that how it works?
So you're bumping up against the limits of my knowledge. What I lack in expertise, I make up for in passion. My staff is amazing and wonderful. And like Tom, we do approach, I believe, in all our heritage definitions, whether it's heritage pork or heritage beef, is that if they both come from heritage animals,
right,
that both the parents are heritage animals, then we can use that definition. They may be crossed, and there may be reasons for the product that you want to get to cross them. So I think we're in alignment with what Tom was describing.
And I think stripping this back to the basic level, it's these animals represent, they have it's biodiversity, and they've got traits, characteristics, and genes that we probably don't know a thing about. Is that something that is fundamental to your organization, Tom?
Oh, absolutely. But don't remember, it's two types of biodiversity here as well, in a way. It is the animals, and we desperately need that. There's loads of new uses been found for animals that over here now we're grazing Christmas tree plantations with Shropshire sheep because they don't eat the bark off the things, and they've genetically found that actually is the case, We've got our North Ronaldsey lamb eating nothing but seaweed and kelp.
Right.
That's farming the oceans of the future.
Yeah.
And it tastes good. But also, when you graze with proper animals that are meant to graze in there, it increases the plant biodiversity because of the different ways they graze, which increases the invertebrate biodiversity. You know, so actually by using the right animals, you'll have more birds flying around. You know, it is that. So it's a whole holistic thing. You know, this is what we did traditionally. It worked traditionally. And these animals don't need the chemical inputs that are now. All right, this week the oil price is coming down, but in the long term we know it's only going to go one way.
Indeed.
And these animals don't need the oil in the form of fertilizer and sprays and chemicals.
So really it's reverting back to an older way of doing things in many ways.
In using the best of both worlds,
yeah.
You know, you learn from the past, you know, and you go forward. So it's not just about tradition, it is about, you know, going forward as well.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you both about your most exciting discovery or project, because looking at this, at the world of rare breeds, there seem to be these little nuggets that keep coming up, and that's so exciting. So, Eric, what is currently on the radar of the Livestock Conservancy, something that's sort of come up where you go, well, that's kind of cool?
I don't have a specific example, but an example, I have several examples that point to that we're becoming more and more aware that we don't know what we don't know. So we know we're losing breeds. We know their breeds are out there, but we have no idea what else is out there that we aren't even aware of. And this comes back to us when we were a project we were doing for the to rescue the Choctaw horses, the colonial Spanish breed that belonged to the Choctaw Indian tribes as they were driven on the Trail of Tears from the southeast to Oklahoma. They took those horses with them. They were kind of running wild and in interbreeding. We had a project that to keep that breed pure. And in the process, we discovered these Choctaw pigs that we thought had been interbred out of existence.
Uh-huh.
And we found a true breeding population of about, about 200 or so. So we actually were able to find a breed that we thought had disappeared. And this happens more often than not. Jeanette will be down in Mississippi, and somebody will say, hey, Mrs. Chaw has these blue chickens down the road. You should look at them. It turns out they trace their ancestry back to 200 years ago, 200 or 300 years ago to France, and they are been true breeding true in this one family in the backwoods of Mississippi for 200 years.
Wow.
And so those things are out there. If we just had more people on the ground or more people that were aware of what the issues were and would say, hey, somebody has this odd breed of cattle down the road.
Tom, you've got some interesting stuff. I think you've got the Bagot goat.
The Bagot goat is just an interesting project that the team pick up. You know, we've got a very small population of a Bagot goat. I'm not quite sure why we keep the Bagot goat. To some extent, it was used in parks and looks very pretty. But, you know, there's less than 200 breeding females, and we've just been able to manage to save about 35 of them from somebody who'd fallen ill, and we picked them up. So, you know, just actually being able to have to be in the right place at the right time to do those things, we'd have lost 10% of the genetics. Had one of our field officers not been in the right place at the right time, and Ruth did a great job. And there's loads of those little projects that are happening around and about, and a bit like Eric was just saying, you know, a couple of years ago, we found some Oxford and Sandy Blacks, which we thought were extinct, and we've been able to bring them back in there, and they're fantastic-looking pigs. And you know, the things like the Shropshires I just said about Chris Shropshire sheep and the Christmas tree grazing. But I think the other thing that I've found is the volunteers we have out there and the willingness they are to help us do our work and how unsung they are and how much work they do. And they do some fantastic stuff.
It's certainly an issue which people I'm finding are getting very passionate and involved with. And, you know, long may it. I just let into a secret with the Shropshire sheep and the Christmas trees. Somebody was telling me that they're okay on the Norway spruce, but if you put them in with the pretty blue trees, the blue spruce, I think they eat those. But I didn't tell you that. I think they're good on the Norway, the sort of the brittle, tough ones. But if you put them on a nice bit of blue spruce, they might just nibble. But that's for another day. Tom, Terra Madre, you attended. You found that very fulfilling and very good for the cause.
It was absolutely fantastic, you know, because there was on so many levels. You know, we do. I sort of mentioned the North Ronaldsay Lab. Now, if I was to leave here now and get to North Ronaldsay in Orkney now, that would probably take me a day and a half to get there. It's probably the most remote place, or one of the most remote places in the UK.
Right.
But Billy Muir, or Billy the Goat, as I've christened him, was there. So I was able to spend 2 or 3 days with the most entertaining character. I met a really fantastic chef who I kept meaning to go up to see from the north of England, who's like rare breeds through and through, knows more about it than I do. Again, I think I've sent you another article about him. Callum Edge, and absolutely brilliant. So just to go and meet those people. Over here, we've just started really over the last 10 years producing salamis, a couple of really good salami producers, and some great chefs from across the UK. But also, I think it was the opportunity to meet the guys that you've got coming on, and Richard from the States, and actually have the conversations about our similarities and the learning experience of that. And I'm sorry, anywhere I can go and eat great food and have a good coffee, it's fab.
That goes with the turf. Eric, I'd just like to ask you about the ticklish question of the President of the United States, Mr. Obama, and his perhaps pardoning a heritage turkey. Now, I think it would be a really neat idea, but every year a white bird drops on the table and gets pardoned. Do you think we could get a heritage breed pardoned?
That is our goal for next Thanksgiving. Jeanette is fond of saying when one of those big broad-breasted white turkeys gets pardoned, it's relegated to a short, miserable life because those birds can't even walk across a barnyard on their own or find food on their own.
Or reproduce, actually. I think, let's be quite honest. If they to be called heritage, they have to breed naturally. So, and a lot of those white birds kind of struggle in that department, if we're honest. But so that's kind of really, really interesting.
Look for next year. Next year, heritage bird.
Although technically, as we're trying to eat them all, it's kind of an oxymoron. You don't really want to be doing that. You want to be eating them all. But then if one's pardoned, it would be huge, huge for the breed.
Make sure it's a breeding stag, Eric.
Yeah, an old one. An old one that's seen some action and decides to head west. Gentlemen, thank you. It's been a great opportunity of getting some information out there about traditional rare breeds from both sides of the pond, and I wish you both a happy Christmas, and thank you for coming on, and may your collaboration prosper. Thank you very much, guys. We'll cut to a short break now. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you, John.
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
Welcome back to the whole shebang. My name is John Wilkes, and I'm in the studio today, and we're looking at historic breeds. And we have with us today from Slow Food USA, Megan Lama, who is Director of Biodiversity. Megan, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, John.
It's a pleasure. First of all, please pass to Richard our get well soon best wishes. Richard McCarthy's had a lot today, and we hope he gets better really soon. But Megan is stepping in, and we are so pleased to have you on, Megan. It's brilliant. Thank you so much. Just so very quickly, as you probably can gather, we're looking at breeds, traditional, rare, heritage breeds. And at Slow Food, you are very much involved through the Arc of Taste with breeds of livestock and also all sorts of other interesting stuff. Perhaps you could tell us about that.
Absolutely. So we have been working with the Arc of Taste, which is a catalog of rare and endangered foods. And breeds are, of course, an integral part of this. And we've been really lucky to have the Livestock Conservancy as a partner in that work for many, many years now. Now, people often ask me what is, you know, the difference between the Arc of Taste and, say, an endangered species list or something like this.
Yeah.
And the real interesting part about the Arc of Taste is that it tries to capture not just the genetic diversity or even maybe the colors and shapes of the animals that would be captured in a rare breed list, something like this, but also the intangible cultural elements that go along with the raising of these animals. One of our favorite examples from the U.S. is the Navajo Churro sheep. And this is a sheep that was forcibly removed from the Navajo Nation during the 20th century, so that very few of these sheep still remain. Now, the way of life that goes along with raising these sheep also, of course, will disappear, as well as the way of eating when those sheep have disappeared from the land. So protecting them and bringing them back has been a really central project for the Arc of Taste in the U.S., and it correlates to many others that are happening internationally with the Arc of Taste as well.
Yeah, the Churro sheep are an interesting breed. I had the good fortune of speaking with the Navajo Nation's sheep specialist at the American Sheep Industry convention last year, and it was very interesting. They're a wonderful breed, and they feel passionately about these animals. And it's great that you guys are looking to, you know, preserve and help them, keep them viable. And what I like, I mean, I was looking through the Arc of Taste, because it's not just about livestock, and I'm going to take my livestock hat off now, and you've got all sorts of wonderful stuff on the list: boil cider, Delaware Bay oysters, Gulberry honey, and it's more of an all-encompassing thing, this, is it? It's about sort of tastes and seeds and a whole range of sort of products.
That's exactly right. It's really highlighting the relationship that is central to Slow Food's mission generally, which is the relationship of humans to the production of their food and how those are not inseparable things. Nature and the field songs and the types of tools we use both in the field and in the kitchen, and the consumer at the far end of that, these aren't separate extractable pieces of a system, but a holistic part of an entire system that we're trying to draw attention to and protect through the Arc of Taste for one program. Yeah.
So it's a great list. And is the ethos behind it really that we eat less meat and just better quality and better sourced and better produced meat? Is that the kind of thinking?
Well, so that is specifically the mission of Slow Meat, which is a new program that we have just begun to explore this last summer when we had our first Slow Meat Symposium in Denver.
Right.
And we will be reconvening the Slow Meat Symposium again this June in Denver.
Denver, yeah, that's it.
Yeah. The idea behind the less meat better is yes, indeed. If we are going to be protecting these rare breeds, well, you also have to protect the people who produce them, who are going to need to sell that product at a higher price to compensate them fairly for all the external costs that are part of raising an animal in a humane way, in a sustainable and biodiverse system. Costs that are not accrued by industrial farmers, but are offset into public health and things like that.
Indeed.
Eating a little bit less meat can help people to be able to afford to eat the better meat, and also reduce some of the environmental impact of these really large-scale meat production systems.
So I guess you've an initiative, Eating Nose to Tail,
mm-hmm.
which is basically eating the whole thing, In a pig's case, they reckon you can eat everything bar the squeal. But you're having these eating nose-to-tail events, and is it nose-to-tail gating? Can you tell us a bit about that? How does that work?
Sure. So nose-to-tail is certainly something that we're sort of hopping on the bandwagon of, and I loved hearing Tom Beeston speak earlier about his work with rare breeds, and certainly the UK led the charge in nose-to-tail eating. And as we were at this symposium in Denver last summer discussing the issues around meat, what can slow food specifically as a community, what new part do we bring to this conversation, we thought, well, nose-to-tail is right in our wheelhouse. How do we make it something that reaches beyond the choir, that can really turn the herd of more than just those who are already committed to the slow food mantra, you know?
Getting the word out there.
Yeah, exactly. And reach across to folks who maybe have not traditionally been part of the folks that we work with. And as we were thinking of meat food traditions in the U.S., the tailgate, of course, came to mind. You know, this is amazing outdoor festive celebration of really very American barbecue, American football. You know, it's a very particular event. So we thought if we could get this idea of nose to tail into the parking lots of these stadiums, draw attention to the amazing food culture that we already have happening there, then this would be a great way for us to also start to say to the people inside the stadium, you know, this is what the people in the parking lot want. They want real food. They want good food. They want connection to each other. They want connection to the producers. And shouldn't that start to happen inside the stadiums as well? So we had a great event at MetLife Stadium last month with the Big Blue Tailgate Crew, who were this amazing group of chefs that used a mule foot hog, which is one of the rarest breeds in the U.S. They prepare just an incredible feast, an absolutely incredible feast.
That sounds delicious. I wished I had been there. For me, that's one of the issues I think that is hard to get. Americans are so used to eating sanitized, prepackaged, recognizable cuts and bird meat. I mean, it's very difficult to get Americans to eat lamb. I mean, that's considered kind of, exotic. So, I mean, when you're looking for a meeting of hearts and minds, or if I was going to crack a gag in hearts and livers, which is fabulous, by the way. So, particularly with some nice onions. I'm going off on one now. It's lunchtime. That's my thinking. How are you going to persuade them that the sort of the awful cuts and the other stuff, you know, things like feet, trotters and things like that? How are you going to do it?
So this is also why the tailgate is a perfect forum for this, because two of the things you're most likely to eat at a tailgate would be sausages, usually hot dogs, and hamburgers, you know?
Yeah.
And while we may not, some people may be a little put off by really thinking about it, ground meat and sausages particularly are a great way to use some of the less known cuts. Now, the hope is that once people start to think of those things they're already familiar with and enjoy so much as coming from cuts that they maybe wouldn't see in their butcher store, they'll be a little more open to trying. You know, for example, we had an amazing pozole made out of the head of this mule foot hog, and people were saying, why is this broth so rich? Why is it so amazing? And, well, of course, it's all the delicious gelatinous things that come from stewing a head slowly and for a long time and make that rich broth. So as with all things slow food, you know, you can win them on taste and then get them on theory later.
I see. So you're sneaking under the radar. Yes, indeed. In my farming days, we used to kill our own pigs on the farm, and we used to make a product called brawn from the head meat, where you boil the head and you make a kind of put it into a dish and chill it down, and then it sort of is full of fat and lovely, gorgeous stuff. But that's another way to eat it. Sort of people turn their nose up at it, but it's good. It's good. I'd like to ask you very quickly. Chipotle have stepped in, and they've given you a wonderful, wonderful amount of money over the next 18 months to sort of push the is it inner city gardens?
So that's our national school garden program, exactly, and that will be putting gardens directly into elementary schools in several cities across the country, helping to engage children in thinking about the production of food from the earliest point.
That's great. Catch them young. Catch them young.
Yeah, exactly.
Megan, thank you for having the time to talk to us here. It's been a huge amount of fun. And please give Richard our best. And thank you. Look forward to catching you again. We'll now be taking another short break when we come back with Ian Ray, a master butcher from the UK.
In the color of a familiar street, and I ain't gonna breathe.
Long 90 days, Lord, I'm sure.
Long 90 days, it's gonna shiver, and the wind makes a choice and imitates the sweetest voice, breaks your heart in two.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Joining me next, Ian Ray from Ludlow in Shropshire, where he runs a butcher shop, not just any butcher shop, but because Ludlow is one of the foodiest places outside of London. It has three butcher shops, not just one, but three for just 11,000 people that live there. Great shops, shops that the average American walking into would just stand there with their jaw dropping. Ian, good afternoon or good evening to you. How are you?
Hello, John. Good evening. I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Busy day in the shop?
Yes, another excellent day. Thank you very much. Yeah, very good.
Very, very good. And you've been with Wool's Butchers, man and boy.
I have, yeah. I started in when I was 12, and as a schoolboy and after school and on a Saturday, and I'm 53 now, so quite a few years, yeah.
My goodness me, but that's an age. And the business, I was mentioning, obviously, that Ludlow is a very foodie place, and it's, you know, it's received, it gets visitors from all over the country. But your shop is basically a shop for everybody, isn't it? Whether it's the guy who's sweeping the road or the person living in the multi-million dollar townhouse, everybody comes in your shop. Your meat's affordable.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what we like to be. As you say, we have everyone. There is some houses in Ludlow worth £1 million, and we have customers in from that. And also, as you say, we have everyone coming in, which is very, very nice, which is what we want to do. You know, hopefully the meat is affordable to everybody.
And the breeds, I've got to be honest, you're my hometown, so I'm kind of biased. But, I mean, it just happens that you were the foodiest place, so it works. I can say that. So pretty well all of the meat that you sell in the shop is produced locally, is traditional, and it's actually slaughtered locally as well. That's the case, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the case, yes.
And so currently, you were telling me you've got lined up animals booked in to take you through into the new year. What have you currently got lined up beef-wise that's coming
in? Well, for Christmas, which is obviously only 2 weeks away, which obviously we're building that baby. For that week, we've got Highland beef, Longhorn, and British White, and Shetland for that week. for Christmas week. So they got choices of four different cattle.
And that's all produced locally. And you're very fortunate, I gather, in that you have a slaughtering facility very close by where your farmer producers can get these animals killed.
Yeah, well, that's one of the biggest issues for us. Obviously, I'm trying to promote traditional breeds beef and, you know, having that something a little bit different from the other butchers, which seems to be very successful. The people want to know where it's come. It's important as well. They want to know where it comes from. So I can tell them it comes from Edge Jones, Chitty Longville, Mr. Wheeler from Aston Clun,
right,
which are all small villages around the town. But then the big thing is then it's got to be killed locally.
Right.
Unfortunately, just up the road, as you know, in Lentedine, we have a small slaughterhouse. And without that, everything we're trying to achieve would be very difficult. So we don't want cattle travelling 50 miles live to be slaughtered and then having to come back. We want it to sort of all be within 10, 50-mile radius where it's sort of born, bred, yeah, slaughtered locally, come to the butcher shop. I can tell a customer exactly where it's come from. I've gone to all the farms, so I see where they're bred and everything. And that's what the important issue is. So the slaughterhouse to us is fundamental. You know, without that, you know, we can't do the thing we want to do.
It's a very lucky position to be in because, as you know, not just sort of here, but back in the UK. I mean, everybody needs a good slaughterhouse. And coming on to the animals that you select that come into your shop, is it? I mean, really, a thing is organic is less important to you than the actual farmer itself, and you know, you go on the farm, you see where it's coming from, so whether they're organic or not is really secondary to that farmer's how he operates. Yes, it is.
I mean, because, like, generally speaking, the traditional breeds are grass-fed anyway, so they're grass-fed on the farms. You know, it's very important. Like, I like them to be on the grass as long as possible. Some of them do bring them in for sort of a month, 6 weeks, to put them on a bit of grain just to get a little bit more covering on them, which is just to finish them off, which is very nice. But I do like them to spend most of their time out on the field, and the great thing about most of these cattle are all very hardy, so they can put them out summer and winter.
Yeah, I mean, that's and it's mostly the grain that they would be produced on farm as well.
On the farm as well, yes.
Yeah. So you're kind of putting your own standards in, which is kind of good. I mean, in relation to pricing, just to give you know, our listeners in the States some idea, your lamb chops are currently on the counter at what?
$13.77 a kilo.
Which is like nine. I did the maths beforehand, you see, so I'm all organized. So that's like $9 a pound. And leg meat, if you want to buy a really wonderful bone-in leg of lamb from you, what's that going to cost you?
$9.99 a kilo.
Which is $6.80 a pound. And here's the one. Now, free-range chickens, these are produced locally at Springfield Poultry, is it?
That's right, at Steensbridge, which is just sort of, you know, 50 miles away down the road.
50 miles away. And they're currently, for free-range chicken, how much are you charging your customers?
£5.10 a kilo.
Which is like $3.40. And just lastly, so I can get people's eyes watering, a ribeye. So your best ribeye is?
Ribeye, $10.33 a kilo. And that's Carvery ribs. So that's just the long ribs.
Just the long rib. Okay. I mean, which translates, because that's a kilo, is 2.2 pounds. But if you break it down, it's like $13 a pound, which is quite extraordinary, really. I mean, it really is. Can we talk sausages for a minute?
You can,
because you happen to have a secret recipe, which is world-famous sausage recipe, where you make these special Ludlow sausages, which win all sorts of accolades at the big annual food fair that's held in Ludlow in September, where I think 20,000 people rock up to Ludlow in the old Norman Castle for the food fair. So this, I'm just interested. I know you can't tell me because it's kept in a safe, the recipe. So what is in it, sort of? You can tell me. No one's listening. You're fine.
Well, that's what it's a Ludlow sausage. Just to give you an idea, it's been in Ludlow for all sort of 70 years. I mean, Joneses were one of the original butchers years ago. They were the first to produce it. Then Carters, who have been established in Ludlow for a long time, they took it on. When he retired, he sold the recipe to me. So it's been carried on now for sort of three different butcher shops since the sort of 1940s.
That is wonderful.
And so it's got, you know, a really old recipe. Obviously, there's many different ingredients, but to be fair, it is a traditional pork sausage.
Right.
You know, it's nothing fancy. We do lots of different varieties, but what people, you know, the general public want, just a good, meaty pork sausage.
A British banger. And
that's right. And, you know, every time they sort of, you know, that outsells all the others put together by far.
What you sell per week, I mean, yours is a little tiny shop with respect. You're right in the middle of the town, and it's a tiny shop, and the amount of stuff you move is unbelievable. You're telling me, how many pounds a week of sausage do you move? It's staggering.
Well, just the Ludlow sausage, we make two 500 lots a week.
So that's like
500 pounds, that is. 500 pounds a week.
So that's 500 pounds a week.
No, two times by two. On a Monday and a Thursday, we make them.
That's a thousand pounds, and that's without the other flavoured sausages you do as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Quite staggering. I'm starting to salivate here at the thought of it all. My goodness me. But it's really great having you on. And I just want to mention very quickly, over here we can't get it to the same extent, game is a big part of what you do in your shop. I mean, in your shop this time of year, hanging up a pheasants outside, and what other stuff have you currently got which is on full display that anybody can buy?
Okay, we've got pheasants, partridge, hares, rabbits, wild boar, venison, the wild ducks, everything. I mean, our local authority are really good with us as well to allow us to have the feathered game hung in the shop as well. So, you know, they've got to be appreciated as well for letting us do that sort of thing, and they're quite happy with how it all runs.
So they were. That's good. Now that's interesting. The local sort of trading standards that enforce the health laws are happy to work with you on that.
They are. They're very good. As long as we keep it parted, uh-huh, then they're more than happy. And it's, you know, and it's great because you've seen it yourself. You know, it gives a.
It looks wonderful. It's like something out of a film
Americans
set.
Look, but also even people from London and Birmingham, they just think it's marvellous to see as well. Like,
it's great. I think I'll pass that down the line to the USDA. They could take a hint on that one. Ian, thank you so much. You're going out now, I expect. It's Friday evening. Have a great time. Thank you for talking to us.
It's
been wonderful. See you again soon, and I'll take a couple of £1,000 of sausages off you. How's that?
Thank you very much.
You can make them.
Very
take
good
care.
To thank you, John. Cheers.
Take care. We're going to a short break now, when I will be bringing in Simon Collins, who is an appetizing guru, I think I'll call him. Anyway, we're taking a short break now and back for the last part with Simon Collins. Simon, how are you?
Hi, John.
Are you good?
I am, but I hope you're not going to start talking about boiling pigs' heads again.
No, it's my guilty pleasure. I only do it at weekends. You're good. You're good. I can describe you. I've got here that you're almost Yoda-esque in that you're an international creative and you work all over the place, and a long career in London and in New York and in Sydney. And I was going to bring you in on this to look at these organisations, these two organisations, at the Livestock Conservancy and the Rare Breed Survival Trust, to perhaps put a little bit of a slant as to how these guys can, how can you sell, how can you create a brand around these organisations to make them people friendly?
Well, I'm sure that anything I can say probably hasn't. I'm sure it's probably occurred in various forms to Eric and Tom, and certainly more so perhaps Megan, because if you like, I think Slow Foods is a little bit closer to the, if you like, the consumer face than either the Livestock Conservancy or the Rare Breed Survival Trust. But listening to those guys talking, I thought it was very interesting the semantics of the discussion. You know, there were words like membership and things were bandied around, which, yeah, of course, I know that they're both dependent on, if you like, caring individuals, donors, people who are, if you like, probably involved as much as from an emotional point as for as from a, any kind of, nakedly commercial sense. But one of the things that occurred to me listening to what they were saying was that, you know, and I won't even begin to try and remember some of the names of the breeds you guys are talking about. But it seems to me that one of the most important endangered species here, really, if you like, is the supporter themselves, is the people who support these organizations. Because, as I think was implied by certainly what Eric was saying, that looking forward, you're going to be increasingly dependent on what might become a smaller pool of of donors and people who have a genuine interest in these things. And the, I mean, they clearly do great, organizations do great work and kind of, they're obviously committed to ensuring the survival and continuance of these kind of important parts of our heritage and history. But there are two ways to preserve anything.
Yeah.
One is to sort of ring fence it, you know, to ensure that it's protected, and looked after, and you know, and kept out of harm's way, and that's the way we deal with things like, you know, that's why we put you know, great art in art galleries, and we don't let developers knock down beautiful cathedrals, we ring fence them like that. The problem is, you can only do that with things which have an inherent and clear value to a lot of people.
Exactly right.
So you know, most people would agree that you can't go and knock down St. Paul's Cathedral to build a car park, you know, even if they've got parking problems themselves. And most people would agree that it's probably a good idea to have the Met full of fine art that the general public can come and see for the same reason. And you know, if you wanted to take it into the area of animals and things and breeds, you know, when you get things like the giant panda. Now, the giant panda is something that, you know, the World Wildlife Fund uses as its logo, and they know because people, the general public have a value invested in that, which
right.
they think is cute and so on and so forth. And you could say the same of, you know, the blue whale and things. You know, people clearly accept that there is a need to preserve certain things, and they will act accordingly, and sometimes at their own cost.
Right. So, I mean, but what you're saying is really, you know, how do you get them to love an ugly chicken?
Well, it's not so much love. I think I would, I'm a hard-faced, hard-bitten advertising man. So I would say value. And I don't mean, you know, I would say, I apologize to both Eric and Tom because I'm probably saying things that they've said and thought out loud themselves. But it's about changing thing, you know, members to consumers.
Right.
And when I say consumers, I don't mean that they have to actually necessarily go down to, eat more of these animals. It could just be that they kind of, there is a kind of a cultural value that you could place on them. You know, it could be educational or something. And I'm sure that they go a long way towards doing this in the various activities they were describing.
Right.
But
So you're kind of saying that they need to look around the various breeds to find other aspects other than just the physical consuming of that what is there that someone can latch onto that they might find comforting in that this particular animal does this or that, rather than that it tastes damn good with fries.
Yeah, I mean, I think the. There's all kinds of ways you can pitch a product or a brand to give it consumer appeal. You know, I mean, there's a kind of an analogous situation that I worked on not very long ago. Was I helped the Australian wool, merino wool producers. You know, they were having, you know, like a lot of, you know, proper, you know, wool producers around and cotton producers around the world are being attacked on all sides by synthetic fibers.
Right.
Now, the truth is that there's a lot of synthetic fibers that do as good a job as wool, you know, in terms of pure product performance.
Yeah.
So the pitch you take, you know, so the campaign I produced was all about, you know, it could be educating people that, you know, in fact, synthetic fibers are produced from oil. So you're creating, you know, you're helping to create environmental problems by buying nylon or you know, these other synthetic fibers. Or it could just be creating a snob value at the high end of the market. And,
right.
and you know, I think that Megan's conversation was really interesting because, you know, in many ways, that just the term slow food, which I think is brilliant, is a brilliant piece of positioning because it's the antithesis of what a lot of people who have high-end consumer values, you know, the last thing they want to be doing for themselves and for their children, perhaps,
yeah.
is give them fast food. So, you know, you create inherent value in something which will cost more money.
That's the thing.
But just the additional cost, as Megan points out, is not going to deter a lot of people.
Yeah, it's
the cost factor in all this is potentially going to put people off.
Of course it is, but
as you say, if you can foster some kind of interest in the breed from a different angle, I mean, that's the, you know, you're kind of winning.
I think the whole, you know, it's I'm not saying that either Livestock Conservancy or Rare Beast Tribe would ever be able to fund anything like a national advertising campaign. But the way that, you know, to me it seems the natural way of doing it is to form partnerships with organizations such as you mentioned, Chipotle with Slow Foods. That Chipotle is a company that is doing brilliantly well, and it's largely because they're doing a good job of telling people about the way they produce their, you know, their meats, which is, you know, if you go to their website, it's really fantastic, and it's engaging young people as well as, you know, as well as the people who go out and buy for the family. It's really engaging very young people in learning to value you know, meats that are produced humanely, naturally, organically, and so on.
So you're saying really that these guys should be pitching at you know, the likes of Chipotle, other big organizations, sort of.
Well, I think it's very simply that organizations like that have the kind of financial muscle to take the messaging of, you know, very valuable and worthwhile messaging of people like Livestock Conservancy,
yeah,
into a much bigger public domain.
Right.
It's great to have informative websites. It's wonderful to be doing blogging about it and that kind of thing. And the events like the MetLife Stadium event that we heard about,
yeah,
that's wonderful too. But to an extent, you're always going to be preaching to the converted there. If you really want to ensure that the people who support it survive in large numbers, you need to kind of give it some kind of larger public interface, and you know, a very perfectly reasonable way of doing that is to partner with, you know, with a large commercial branded operation. Chipotle are a superb example of that.
Just a very quick one, then I've got to wrap up now. But would you say that you know, 500,000 is a Chipotle getting a good deal for that in relation to the strength of the brand of Slow Food?
I'm not a money man. I'm at the creative end of it. John.
I know, but you've got an idea.
I don't want to say anything that's going to stop me getting any work.
That's impossible. Everybody wants to employ you, Simon. It's just interesting. It's all numbers, but it's numbers.
I did get a great commercial idea though, which I was going to run past you. What do you think? I was thinking, talking of partnerships between organisations, I was thinking. You know, wouldn't it be great if we could go along and persuade McDonald's, you know, to include in their range a new duck product? Just think, it'd be worth doing just for the lawsuit from Disney if they produced a product called McDonald Duck.
Yes, I think you'd probably want a big checkbook for that one to pay the fines afterwards. Simon, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us on the show.
No worries.
We'll catch you again. Thank you very much. And as I say, this has been John Wilkes. I've been the whole shebang. And I hope you've been informed, educated, and perhaps titillated a tiny bit during the show. And look forward to joining you again in the near future when I will bring another topic under the microscope. Thank you very much and good afternoon.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.